Thank you. On the local currencies, fantastic idea. What's the tax collector's feelings about local currency?
Did everybody hear the question? Okay. Well,
you understand my question?
Yeah, no, I do understand your question, yeah, and I've been asked it many times. So, the first ones, Totnes and Lewis and Stroud and those kind of early experiments, were kind of under the radar. Nobody was really that bothered about them, really. When it was in the paper they were going to launch the Brixton Pound, they got a phone call from the Bank of England. And so they went up and they met the Bank of England for about 3 hours, and they were grilled and grilled and grilled. And passed whatever the test was, they passed the test. Their legal status is like book tokens. They aren't officially a currency as such, but they have the legal status of book tokens. So you turn sterling into them, and then they still have the same value as sterling, but they're in a different form. So in some places, you can bring them back and swap them back for sterling whenever you want. I think in Bristol and Brixton, there's like a 3% surcharge if you want to do it, because you want to try and encourage shops that have them in tills to really think it through. Well, what are we going to do with these? Rather than just think, oh, we'll just change it back and turn it into sterling again. Actually, you want them to think, oh, we could spend them with so-and-so and so-and-so. But in terms of tax, they go through the tills like normal money. They go through the books like normal money. And it was a very intentional thing when we were designing the first ones, was that one of the main limitations with things like lets schemes was that lets never really got taken up by shops. You couldn't really go shopping with lets. And actually for us, we wanted it to be that the local traders would take them, and that was what would kind of help give it its legitimacy. So they go through, as far as the tax man is concerned, they go through like any other, they just go through the books as if they were money.
So can you pay tax on them?
Only, you can't pay your national tax on them. But in Bristol, you can now pay your council tax.
So the government and the VAT now are not losing out.
No.
I'm so glad to hear it.
Well, yeah, I think that's kind of important, because you know we need to be able to be paying for all kinds of different things, and it's not about everywhere shutting down. It's almost like building in. You know, because all the Bristol pounds that are in circulation are backed by sterling in a bank account. And so what the schemes do as well is, in our experience in Totnes, was that actually about a quarter of the notes are lost, because people take them away as souvenirs. They email them as Christmas presents to grandma in Australia. They nail them onto the wall. They wallpaper their bathroom. You know, people do all kinds of mad things with them. So what the Bristol and the Brixton one do is they bring out a new note every couple of years. So then the old notes go out of circulation. So then that money that's basically been lost from the system, you know you have it, and you can use that to invest in community initiatives and projects.
So can I just ask, you said a chap in Bristol,
yeah,
who gets his salary paid.
Yeah, I don't think he has a mortgage. I think he is a man of independent means.
Right, but I was also wondering what the tax implications were for that.
Could
he actually be taxed on his?
That's a very good question. I don't know. I know that both Lambeth Council, who support the Brixton Pound, and Bristol Council, if you work for those councils, you have the opportunity to receive a proportion of your salary in the local currency, and then they increase it a little bit as a, kind of as an incentive. But I don't know about his tax affairs. Yes.
Some fascinating, very inspiring examples of things that worked, which is great. But sometimes one can learn a lot from the things that people have tried and haven't worked so well.
Absolutely.
I wonder if you've got a few key thoughts about things that haven't.
Yeah, absolutely.
Offers that are things like that.
Yeah, I mean. You know, there are transition groups that just run out of steam. It's hard to sustain, and there's all kinds of reasons for that. Sometimes groups come together and they just don't get on. Sometimes, you know, actually trying to completely transform the economy of the place that you live on your Wednesday evenings feels like a bit of a big ask, really. And life changes and people move on and other people come, and And sometimes, so Transition Oxford lasted for about 2 years, and then they just sort of dissolved because they had taken on trying to transition the whole city of Oxford, and there are about 8 of them, you know. It's like I say, it's different in every place. So some places, you know, you have like in Bristol and in Sheffield, where Transition Sheffield and Transition Bristol are a kind of a relatively small group, but they kind of network things and they sort of sit along and they just drop that transition idea into lots of different settings. So the Bristol Pound came about because Transition Bristol worked with the City Council to produce the first peak oil plan that a city ever did in the UK, and then from that they did the first food resilience plan for a city in the UK, and they built a relationship with the council that meant that was possible. Some transition projects just fall out with, only about 2 that I know of, just fall out with each other absolutely spectacularly. Sometimes in places where you kind of wouldn't expect, you think they would be able to manage a really good transition group, and it just goes really quite horribly pear-shaped. Mm-hmm. But as Transition Network, you know, what we try and do is offer support for groups who are doing this. And so that's something that we try and do in a whole range of different ways. And there's really good trainings. There's a very good training called Transition Launch, which is for that initial stage. It's a 2-day training for that first stage about how do you try and iron all those things out and get all those agreements in place at the beginning that are going to maximise the opportunity of success. And then another one called Transition Thrive, which is a very good 2-day training for after a couple of years when maybe things feel a little bit flat and need kind of pepping up again. So there is support there. I suppose that, those challenges are different in every place. Yeah.
You also don't know what effect has been had peripherally in things that seem to fold.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And sometimes things fold, and then a couple of years later, then they kind of come back together in a bit of a different way and actually have a lot more momentum than they had before. Transition Lancaster, in about 2007, 2008, had the most horrendous, acrimonious bust-up and all huffed off in different directions, and then came back about a year later and really kind of started much more mindfully saying, okay, how are we going to run the meetings? How are we going to work together? What are we going to do if we come up against conflict? And they really much more maturely designed how they were going to work as an organisation, and now they're flying. So, you know, sometimes there's always that tension between running in and going, let's just do stuff. Yeah, let's just go and plant trees and dig gardens and get on with it. And saying, actually, we also need to make sure we get the process right about how we're all going to work together. And I think that balance in transition is a really interesting one to get right. Yes, sir.
You partially answered this, I think, and Oxford and Bristol, which are cities. How important do you think the sort of physical proximity of people is to the success of what you're doing?
I think in very rural areas it can kind of struggle to hold the kind of the presence somehow, I think. I suppose the one in Matlock, actually, the DE4 Food, you know, they've designed an enterprise that sort of covers a relatively dispersed kind of rural area. And in some places, there was one place, I can't remember where it was now, but there was a town where nothing was happening in transition, but it was people from all the villages around the town who said, well, there's no point us really doing transition without the town, because the town is the hub of this area. And it was those people who were coming into the town to try and get transition going in the place. And, you know, quite early on, people would come and say, well, it sounds all very well, it'll work. Of course, it'll work in market towns. It was never going to work in the cities. But actually, London is, I think, where some of the most interesting transition stuff is happening. There's 50 different transition initiatives across London, all very, very different, doing different stuff, but all networked and sharing those kind of experiences. And being able to do things there on a scale that maybe other people can't do. But I think it's what you see again and again is it takes a handful of people to kick it off and get it started. And this is all an experiment, and it does work in those places sometimes.
So you mentioned right at the beginning of your talk about climate change, that the experts are now saying we need 10% emissions cuts in the UK year on year, starting more or less now. Given the kind of examples that you were talking about, you know, they're all very early and new and now and exciting, but have you done any kind of
kind of calculations as to how quickly we have to expand this movement in order to make a contribution to this, and how much could we be meeting what is urgently required.
That's a very good question. The main bits, I mean, there's the transition streets data about how much data was cut. There was a very interesting paper that came out recently from Fife Diet in Scotland, where they have 5,000 people in Fife in Scotland who've committed to eating a diet which is 80% local seasonal produce. And they calculated that, so this year the Scottish government missed its carbon targets for the second year running, and they calculated that if everybody in Scotland ate that diet, then it would be 60% of the cuts that were needed to be made or something. I mean, it was some big sort of contribution to that. You know, I mean, it's why I say, you know, actually transition can't do it on its own. It needs all kinds of different things. But that transition is the really is a really important piece of that puzzle that is still far too small. And I don't know if it's going to be enough and if it's going to be in time. But it feels to me that we're starting to be able to see how that thing can scale up, and actually there is a lot of interest increasingly to getting behind that. You know, there are people who come to us who are investors who would love to put money in and make that happen, but then we still don't have enough. It's getting it all, you know, there aren't that many people still kind of culturally in the people who are drawn to something like transition. There is that aversion to thinking, right, let's set up an energy company, let's think about that kind of stuff. You know, so we need to get all those things lined up, and whether we can do it in time, there's no guarantee about that, really. But I think it's a really key part. Yeah.
If you get big investment and big commercial money behind local energy projects, at what point, and then what local, at what point are you again giving the money back to people who've already got money?
That's a good question. I think what the Scottish and Southern, what the story in Bath really shows beautifully, is that it's inward investment that actually enables the internal investment to happen in a way that it would struggle to do otherwise. So it's kind of used to kind of prime things, not to kind of swamp it and dominate it and extract it. But if you can do it skillfully to kind of enable that kind of internal investment to happen, then I think then that's a really key part of it. Yeah.
So this sort of leads to that question. Yeah. I was in a money has two effects. One, it makes things measurable. Because you can measure how much money you've made, you can try and make more money next year. And so that becomes a driver of its own end, and it lets people's ideas go a bit out of control. And it also acts purely on the individual rather than the community. So therefore, if the community is doing something, and that benefit is available to everybody, but you don't put money in, then you're gaining the benefit without putting the money in, therefore you're better off, and that's a sort of social flaw in these things. At what point do you think those sort of effects are going to start to affect what you're doing? Because the transition thing is giving a value to the social side. It's making it socially sustainable. It's making it environmentally sustainable. But you've also got clear acceptance that it needs to be financially sustainable as well. And I guess... Yeah, what do you think will stop the financial side going out of control on that in these projects as they build?
What's interesting in looking at what's happening in Brixton, for example, is so Transition Brixton started out as a very active transition group, and then they seeded lots of different, a food group and an energy group and a local economy group or whatever. And then a lot of those groups then started their own enterprises. So there was the Brixton Pound, Brixton Energy, something called the Remakery. And then these things were set up on their own as social enterprises. And yeah, and then there is the possibility that then they could all just go off and kind of get bigger and bigger. I think the things that restrain that is firstly that actually the vast majority of those things are set up as cooperatives. Without us ever having explicitly said if you start something, make it a cooperative, they're almost always based on those kind of values. And they link back to the kind of transition thing in the middle. And what they started to see in Brixton is the danger of you get this kind of donut effect, where then all the people who started transition and held all the energy for it actually put all their energy into running these different projects, and there's nothing in the middle saying, this is Transition Brixton, and kind of weaving them all together and keeping that narrative that holds them all together. Whereas in other places, they manage to do that. So my sense is the thing that stops that from happening is that you have a kind of, you know, like with the blueprint, you know, you have a kind of a wider story that covers the whole thing, which is about why these businesses matter, why they sit in the context, what's the founding principles of them. You know, so they're founded on the idea of resilience, appropriate localization, low carbon, living with limits, living within limits, returning assets to community ownership where they can. And those values underpin all those things as they emerge. And so far, you know, I mean, that's my sense, is that should be sufficient, but we'll see.
So there's, you've got, because local people have all invested together, they're also getting the benefits of it.
People don't invest in something like that because they want it to grow and grow and become enormous and they can become millionaires.
Yeah.
People invest in it because they love it. And they want it, and they want, and what they invest into is the social return they get, the kind of that idea of impact investing. They get to see that impact as they walk around the streets and see things changing around them. That's why people buy into those things. So I would imagine in those situations, it would actually be the shareholders would be the ones saying, no, the whole point of this is that it stays and performs that particular function. You know, you can't, they're designed in such a way that you can't come in and you can't have a shareholder takeover of the handmade bakery, you know, to try and turn it into some enormous bakery supplying all the supermarkets. The model, you can't do that with the way it's set up.
In the early days of transition, I think there was a big emphasis on developing an energy descent plan, and I was interested in your reflection now of places that have done an energy descent plan, how important that's been, and where you place emphasis now about an energy descent plan.
So for people who don't know what an energy descent plan is, the idea of an energy descent plan was that a community would come together and kind of... Susanna, can I have a glass of water? The community would kind of design a vision and a kind of a timetabled pathway for energy descent, if you like. And so in the transition handbook, that was where it was going. That was the idea, was to achieve it. But actually, when we started researching the next book, The Transition Companion, and going back out to everybody and saying, what are you doing? How are you doing transition? They didn't do those kind of... We had these sort of 12 steps. You know, you do this, then you do this. And everyone said, no. Well, we did that first one, and then we didn't like the second one. And then we went to the fifth one, and then we did this eighth one, and then we did the second one. You know, and it was all kind of all over. And only about five places so far have done them. But they were off and flying and doing all kinds of amazing things. I think... You know, this is all an experiment, and actually, for some places, I found it really, really useful. The one in Dunbar that they did was incredibly useful in terms of building the confidence and the respect of the local council. Some of them, I think, were just a sort of a vanity project in the sense that they weren't really grounded necessarily in something. I think the Totnes one was a really, really useful way of bringing lots of people to really apply their thinking to how that might work. But I think in some ways the blueprints are a really interesting kind of evolution of that, because it sort of argues that economic case. I think what I love about energy descent plans is the creativity in them and the sort of telling the story, and it really helps to bring it to life and using Photoshop to do sort of what it might look like and all that kind of stuff. But it's a big piece of work, and like all of these things, like I said before, you know, if your passion is growing food, you're not going to start a cycle club or something. If you've got people in the community and they decide that's what they want to do, then it's a great thing to do. But you can only really build off the passion, things of what people are really passionate about.
Thank you very much for this. I'm quite tantalised by what you were saying about looking at how you look after the elders of the community and
Well, I wasn't that involved in it, but I know if the Totnes economic blueprint is available online, and there's a whole section in there about it. I think it's increasingly one of the side effects of austerity is the whole thing of, you know, sort of off tendering out all of those kind of things and the service getting worse. And I think the idea was that if you looked at care for the elderly in a different way in the community, and there are places, there's some really nice examples now around the country of community-owned care services, that actually you then have the potential to tie that into local food procurement, to tie it into all kinds of other stuff, rather than it just being a little bubble that's serviced by Serco or Virgin Care, Healthcare, or whoever you come in and do it. Actually, the community taking that back, if it's done right, could mean that that money could stay locally and could make all kinds of spin-off things happen. But I didn't, like I said, I didn't write that, but there is a section in the Energy Descent Plan that looks at that. But I think we need to look at all that stuff afresh, really. You know, how can we use how we care for the elderly to help drive that 3% economy? It's a big question. The one we really need to start thinking about.
That underlying problem with the formula and other things that local independent retailers tend to charge more than from bigger supermarkets because of the time of austerity and people have limited income, they're not concerned about paying things as cheap as possible.
Yeah.
Not about sort of going to Rote Mountain High School if you're an independent store. So, well, this just costs more than a supermarket, but I can't afford this.
Yeah.
And I'd rather go to the supermarket where I get everything at once and so on.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think that's why we made that point about what it would look like with a 10% shift, that actually very often in most baskets that you would buy from the supermarket, probably about 10%, and probably the 10% that's the fruit and vegetables, you could buy cheaper in a local independent business. And actually, and by doing so, there's all the benefits of that. You know, and actually often with supermarkets, you end up coming home with a whole load of stuff that you didn't really want in the first place. And actually, there's a really interesting kind of tension there because, yeah, when money's tight and there's not much money around in the community, we shop in the supermarket because the majority of the things in there would tend to be cheaper. But then at the same time, the average salary that Tesco pays is about £12,000 or something.
Hopefully, they're working Tesco.
No, but the thing is that the more you support the supermarkets, the more it tends to kind of drive down wages and stuff in the area around where the supermarket is. So it kind of becomes a sort of a cycle in that way. But I think if we can just look at 10% as an initial push, then actually I think it's quite interesting because you start to move away from a lot of local food campaigns that are buy local food, here's a cloth bag with buy local food written on it, to actually supporting people and saying, well, what's in the shopping basket? Let's have a look. You know, actually, do you know, you could get that stuff cheaper from there, and you start to really acknowledge that cost thing rather than pretending it doesn't exist.
You mentioned the five diets and about changing the diet so that you're buying more local, more seasonal food. And that's precisely the kind of food that local suppliers would be able to supply at a cheaper price than or a comparable price to the supermarket. I think something that I've been doing for a few years now is go to the local greengrocers, get the stuff from the local greengrocer, and then go to the supermarket afterwards and get the stuff that you can't get from the local greengrocers. Mm. And you get the chance to compare one with the other. Mm. It's just become a habit. But I find that sometimes, yes, there are some trivial things in the supermarket, but overall, I'm not actually spending a bath lot more than I used to when we just used to go to the supermarket and get a new thing. But it just makes you feel good. Thank you.
Yeah,
well,
just made a comment on that. There is an added problem of the supermarket versus local shops, which is the business rating system demoralises local shops. Absolutely crucifies them. The rate per square metre floor area in a local shop is umpteen times what an out of town supermarket. The whole structure of the business rating system is geared up for the supermarkets and to penalise local and independent.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, that example that I mentioned about New Orleans, about the two different places of the same size with the one business and the 100 independent ones. The other thing with the one supermarket, we're actually making far less money and giving even less to the local economy was it also had some like 300,000 square feet of free car parking as well, you know, subsidised. Yeah, no, absolutely. But I just one thing to say about that is actually then also alongside that, there's the whole issue of absentee landlords and all of those decisions that are made. One of the things that we did in Totnes that you might have seen in the paper was that we were one of the only places, I think, to stop a branch of Costa opening in the town. You know, we're a town that has 41 independent places where you can buy a cup of coffee, and they wanted to open a huge Costa right at the bottom of the town where all the tourists arrive, and we'd just go straight in there because it was familiar, and all the ones up the high street would just get knocked out one by one. And the key driver for that wasn't that anybody wanted it, it was because the guy who owned that building had explicitly said, I'm only going to let that space to a chain. I'm not going to let it to a charity. I'm not going to let it to an independent business. I'm only going to let it to a chain. So there's all of those kind of issues as well. But really, it's kind of it's stacked against the local independence from the start.
There's another point that's also in relation to that, and that is independents have a tough time dealing with the banks. And for example, if you want to go to Hong Kong and buy or get a credit card, there's usually a minimum charge. Whereas big chains, they get it for free, which makes it much more difficult.
Absolutely. To compete. So it kind of makes me wonder, you know, what it would look like if there was a kind of a government-led program of supporting that. If it was a policy thing, that the way we want to make the economy grow is by supporting that 3% economy, what would that mean in terms of planning? You know, one of the issues we had with Costa was that we actually lost the planning, because as far as planning is concerned, a coffee shop is a coffee shop. Whether it's a local family with kids in the school who support this, that and the other, or whether it's Costa, it's B1 or it's B2. You know, we can't turn things down or, you know, base it. And the same with all the kind of predatory, how the supermarkets operate, where they've built all the out-of-town supermarkets, which have then killed the town centres off, and then have the indignation to say, well, we need to move into the town centres to revitalise the town centres, you know. So, we need a bit more protection, I think. Oops, a lot more protection in that kind of way. Cool.
It's great. So, very, very... Oh, is there one question here?
Just going back to your first stuff with the stickers on the front of the shop. In terms of Sheffield and how big Sheffield is and this meeting and stuff, I just wanted to ask you how far you thought the ideas of transition is really percolating into that 97%, and how boosting the 3% or 5% of that. How far do you think the whole of the transition movement, 43 nations, thousands of projects, is actually chipping away at that 97%? Because that 97% scares the living daylight out of me.
Yes. Yeah. Well, the thing that I've learned, I think, most out of doing this is you never know where it goes, and you never know who are the people who get touched at the right kind of moment, really. I mean, I got invited, I'm going next week to Paris to an event organised which the French President and the French Prime Minister and the head of the World Bank and people are going to, which is about alternatives to growth, kind of questioning the kind of the growth model, isn't it? And you never quite know where these things go, really. You know, and actually, my sense is that there is a, you know, sort of the Telegraph are running this whole big campaign at the moment about the high street, protecting the high street. How do we revitalise the high street? You know, like the guy from Spain said, you know, people have a sense that something's not right, but they can't quite put their finger on what it is. And COIN, who are the Climate Outreach Information Network, do loads of really good stuff about how we communicate climate change. And they put out this fantastic paper last week about how you communicate climate change to the centre-right, to the people who are sort of conservative voters who tend to be kind of agnostic or they don't believe in it or whatever. And the thing that was really interesting was that basically they said the four things that you need in order to present the climate message to people who are sort of centre-right is you need to talk about localism, about why local communities matter and strengthening local communities. Energy security as an issue, you know, and the implications of that. A new economy for the places where we live. And I can't remember what the fourth one was, but it was like, well, that's transition. really, really interesting. That actually somehow, if we can, and what the report was saying was, we need to kind of strip off the layers that look like the kind of sort of hippie lefty kind of stuff that climate change often kind of gets perceived as, and present something that feels like a great opportunity. And actually, my sense is we can do that. We can nuance this in such a way that it's not about all the things that we're against. It's about celebrating what's fantastic and what people love about this place and what they want to nurture in this place. And that feels something that kind of crosses all kinds of things. And the economic blueprint I talked about for Totnes, the thing that was the proof of the pudding of that for me, was that wasn't something just done by Transition Town Totnes. That was done by Transition Town Totnes, the town council, input from the district council, the chamber of commerce, the schools, the colleges. All those stakeholders came together to produce something that said, we need to start clawing this back. This whole globalisation thing has just swung way too far over that way, and we need to pull it back. It's not about saying we need to go right back up here again, but it's gone too far and we need to swing it back. And I think that's a message that increasingly resonates across the spectrum through the most surprising of people.
To say, very good, thank you for this like really nourishing picture of how we can think things differently and make it happen. So, yeah.
Thank you very much.